Welcome to The Wildlife, a program that probes the mysteries of the animal world through interviews with scientists and other wildlife investigators. I'm your host, Laurel Nemi. Today on The Wildlife, I'll be joined by Rhett Butler, a writer and conservationist who founded MongaBay.com, a top environmental website that seeks to raise interest in and appreciation of wild lands and wildlife. We'll talk about what prompted him to develop this site and also some of the most interesting and bizarre stories that he's pursued. But first, let me play you today's creature call. This week's creature call is from a type of pinniped that you can often see showing off its natural behaviors in shows at zoos, aquariums, and circuses. They make all sorts of strange sounds, from barks to honks to trumpets and roars. Now, listen carefully and see if you can guess today's creature call. At the end of the show, I'll play these sounds again, tell you what kind of animal made them, and also give you a preview of next week's creature call. Now, let me turn to my conversation with Rhett Butler. Rhett is a writer and conservationist who founded MongaBay.com, a top environmental website focused on tropical forests. He's also founded Tropical Conservation Science, an academic journal that aims to provide opportunities for scientists in developing countries to publish their research, and WildMadagascar.org, a site that highlights the spectacular cultural and biological richness of Madagascar. Apart from his websites, Rhett's writing has appeared in the Washington Monthly, Yale Environment 360, BBC News, the Jakarta Post, Conservation Letters, GeoWorld, and Trends in Evolution and Ecology. In the course of his work, Rhett has traveled widely in Africa, Latin America, and Asia Pacific. Before we talked about his travel and writing adventures, I started our conversation by asking what connection he and his name had to either Clark Gable or the infamous character that he played in the classic movie Gone with the Wind.
Well, my name is Rhett Butler, which is well known because it's a character in the main character in Gone with the Wind. But there's actually a connection between my family and the actor who played the character, Clark Gable. My grandfather actually roomed with Clark Gable when Clark Gable was preparing for a role as a test pilot. My grandfather, who was in the Air Corps, was the only survivor in a plane crash. So he wasn't a test pilot, but he was a good person for Clark Gable to get to know, to better prepare for his role. So I had that connection, and then my family name was already Butler, so my parents had a sense of humor and decided to name me Rhett Butler.
People won't forget it, so that's great.
Yeah, people tend to remember the name, so I guess it's one benefit.
Yeah. I'm curious what first got you interested in the natural world?
I was fortunate enough growing up to travel pretty extensively internationally, and that was mostly a product of my mother, who was a travel agent who specialized in kind of exotic travel, and then a father who worked a lot and had an obscene number of miles. So I had a lot of opportunities to travel, and I always liked animals, and as it happened, a lot of animals were in the rainforests of the world, so I really got interested in tropical forests. And then as time went on, a few of the places I visited were destroyed after I visited, and that was really disheartening for me. And I would think about what happened to the animals and the people who lived in those forests. And so that was really the origin for my interest in what I do now.
What place did you visit that was destroyed after? And how did you even find out that it had been destroyed after you were there?
In 1990, I went to Ecuador, the Ecuadorian Amazon, and at the time, there was a lot of oil development going on there. And I think about 8 weeks after I visited, there was an article in the local newspaper, the San Francisco Chronicle, about a giant oil spill that completely fouled this area that I had just visited. And all I could do is think about all that oil, you know, coating the trees, the animals, and all that. And I was only 12 at the time, but it really hit me. And then later in 1996, I was in Malaysia, and I established contact with a researcher there. And a couple months after I got home, I heard from him that the whole area had just been logged for a paper pulp mill. And then later it was converted to an oil palm plantation. So again, it was one of these places where I visited and I saw wild orangutans crossing through the forest. And then a couple months later, the forest was all gone.
And then in school, did you study biology or wildlife?
I actually have kind of an unusual career path. My background is not in this area. I'm actually more of a business economics person. So I have a little bit different approach to looking at these issues.
Tell me about it.
I've always been very recreationally interested in biology and conservation and that nature, and I'm well read in those areas, but I did not study that in school. I studied economics and math and things of that nature, so it's quite different. But in reality, conservation is about people more than biology, interacting with people and figuring out how to actually practically protect these areas. So economics plays an important role in a lot of decisions that are made that tie in with conservation. You know, I'd like to conserve things just for the sake of conserving them, but it's hard to make a justification without some sort of economics, or at least looking at the economics of the situation.
What gave you the idea to create this website, you know, devoted to raising awareness about wildlands and wildlife?
The origin of Manga Bay was actually as a book. I was working on a book about tropical forests that was meant for a general interest audience, kind of the very audience that reads Manga Bay today. It went through several rounds of peer reviews with an academic press, but then the press told me that they weren't planning to run pictures. It was too costly, and that sort of undermined the entire point of the book. So I decided to put the book online for free as Manga Bay. In 1999, so ancient history in web years. And so that was the origin of the site, and it's just expanded since then.
Really? So the idea of running pictures was a deal breaker?
Yeah, it was. And I mean, I didn't set out to build a website that would attract a lot of people. I just wanted to put the information out there so it would be freely available.
Yeah, so what happened? How hard was it to set up this site, and how did it get to be so well known? Actually, maybe give me a little bit of background about Manga Bay for those unfamiliar with it. You know, what kind of articles does it feature, and who are its readers?
Manga Bay is an environmental news and conservation science website. So it details kind of what's happening in conservation, covers a lot of journals as well as kind of news-oriented content. Originally, it was a site about rainforests, and it's kind of expanded into other areas, but the focus is still tropical forests. It was started in 1999 and still going strong today. Draws a little over 2 million visitors a month.
2 million visitors a month, wow.
Yeah, I mean, across all the content, mm-hmm. So it's obviously a big site. There's sections with, you know, travel photos and section on Madagascar and tropical fish. But the real heart of the site is the environmental news and the tropical rainforest sections.
How did you choose the name Manga Bay?
Well, at the time, I chose Manga Bay because it was a unique name. If you typed in Manga Bay on the internet, there were no results back in 1999.
And now?
And now there are lots of results. The name is derived from an island in Madagascar. It's spelled a little bit differently, but it's a really interesting island. It has incredible wildlife, and it's tropical with beautiful beaches, and it's really a great place to visit. And the island left a mark on me, and so I derived the name from that island. And it may not be the best name, but it was a name I chose 11 years ago, and it stuck. So that's where Manga Bay comes from.
How does Manga Bay work? Do you write everything on the site?
Until a couple years ago, I wrote everything on the site. Now I actually have an assistant who probably is writing more than I am, at least this year. His name is Jeremy Hans. And then occasionally we get contributions from other people who want to have their work published on Manga Bay. But I would say around 90-95% of the content today is written by Jeremy or myself. Before about 2007, almost everything was written by me, and the rainforest site is based on the book that I wrote in the 90s and have been updating since then. So that's basically where most of the content comes from.
And how do you get your information? It often seems that you're reporting stories that are really found nowhere else, or in, you know, the scientific journal, in a very dull scientific journal, and you really bring it to life.
Well, I monitor the scientific journals pretty closely. You know, I track around I'm not even sure, maybe 50 journals a week. And Jeremy Hance helps out a lot with that now. So a lot of the content indeed does come out of journals. And then there's also quite a bit of feature content, which comes either from through my travels or my personal contacts. My biggest issue now is not so much finding content. It's kind of dealing with all the content that comes in through personal contacts and things. And I'm kind of barraged by potential stories coming through the email. Yeah, it's mostly an issue of capacity to sort through the stories and spend the time to focus on what readers might be interested in.
How do you choose what topics to feature?
Manga Bay is at heart my project, so it may sound a little funny, but it's kind of stories that I find interesting or topics I find interesting. I mean, now that I brought in Jeremy, my assistant writer, it's changed things a little bit because he can also write about things he finds interesting. But I mean, essentially, most of the stories are topics that one of us is interested in. Although sometimes there are topics that are newsworthy that we don't really want to cover, but we feel like we should because so many people turn to Manga Bay now.
Like what?
So sometimes climate legislation and things like that. I mean, it's important stuff to cover, but it's really well covered elsewhere. So we try and focus more on wildlife conservation, things of that nature, rather than the policy, because a lot of that stuff is covered better by other sources.
So what have been some of the most interesting stories that you've pursued?
Well, recently I've done a lot of reporting on Madagascar, which is a place that's very special to me. But there's also a lot going on. Last year, there was a military coup which displaced the democratically elected president, and that ushered in a period of kind of chaos. The governance structure completely fell apart, and basically the most biodiverse national parks, which are rainforests essentially in the northeastern part of the country, were ransacked by commercial loggers who were taking out high-value hardwoods. So not only were they taking out timber, but they were poaching wildlife. A commercial bushmeat market developed for lemurs, which, if you've ever seen a lemur, is really disheartening because they're just the sweetest creatures you can imagine. So it's a pretty sad situation. And I devoted a lot of time and effort to covering the story when very few outlets were covering it at all. I mean, I wrote dozens of articles and really looked for ways to address the problem. And it's still unclear as to the impact it's had, but I fed some information to some activist groups and really tried to push the matter and managed this combined effort of multiple groups managed to shut down the illegal rosewood trade for about 3 months, which was about a $500,000 a day trade. So it was a pretty significant achievement. And then last week or the week before, this transition authority, which is basically the coup leaders of Madagascar, announced that they were going to place a 2 to 5 year moratorium on timber exports. So that was kind of a victory in terms of this whole Madagascar trade issue. It's not clear whether that moratorium will be enforced, but by announcing something, they're at least taking a step towards addressing the issue. So that was quite hopeful. So again, that was just one story that I reported a lot on lately.
And are there others that were particularly interesting or significant?
There's another one a couple years ago that is pretty noteworthy, and it ties in with the plan to establish a giant oil palm plantation. Oil palm is used for making palm oil on an island off of New Guinea. The island was called Woodlark. What made Woodlark really special is that it had a lot of endemic species. And it was also mostly forested.
So what happened?
So word leaked out that a company had bought logging rights to something like 70% of the island. And they were planning to turn all that into a giant oil palm plantation without the consent of local people. So Manga Bay really covered that story. And Jeremy Hance really led that effort. And the result of a series of articles and then getting those articles in front of the right people was basically the plan was dissolved, so it didn't go forward, and now the island is still forested. So that was quite a happy moment when news came through that the logging of Woodlark wasn't gonna happen.
Wow! How do you cover a story in this case or in the Madagascar case? You travel a lot. Do you always go there, or you're on the phone all the time?
Well, I travel a fair amount, but I can't travel enough to actually visit all these places to do these stories. But in general, we interact a lot with people on the ground. So phone calls, a lot of email. I mean, that's the main way we cover a story. But again, I do travel. I mean, I just did almost a month of reporting in Colombia. I haven't actually written anything yet or published anything yet on that. But I do certainly travel and look into stories. So it's both on the ground reporting, but then also relying on people who are in these places.
Getting back to Madagascar, what first interested you in Madagascar?
Well, what first attracted me to Madagascar was the wildlife. It just has spectacular wildlife: lemurs, chameleons, strange creatures like tenrecs, and
what's that?
All sorts of mongooses. A tenrec is kind of like a little hedgehog, but they have a big variety of them. There's one that's almost like a platypus or an otter. So there's some that are like moles. It's a strange family of mammals, essentially. So that was a draw for me to Madagascar, was really to see these creatures. And so my first trip was in 1997, and I had a really rough trip. And
what happened?
But, lots of things happened. endless array of bad things. I mean, I got robbed on my first night of everything I owned. I was in a boat that sank. I was interrogated by the police. I was attacked on the beach by a guy with a knife. After another.
And you still wanted to go back.
Well, that was the thing, is I still had an interesting, I had an interesting trip, but it was also, I saw a lot of wildlife and I really had an unforgettable experience. And so a couple years later, I concluded that a subsequent trip couldn't be worse than that first trip. So I had to go back. I mean, the love affair with Madagascar really started with that first trip, but, now I've been back several times and it's my favorite place to visit, and I would highly recommend everyone going there. Well, everyone who's flexible enough to deal with some, unexpected difficulties at times. But the wildlife is really, really great there. And then once you actually interact with or see these lemurs and things up close, it's even more amazing than you can imagine.
Really? So what's it like? How many lemurs are there?
Well, the number of lemurs has gone from 50 about 15 years ago to over 100. So basically they're discovering that there are a lot more lemurs than they originally believed.
Meaning species of lemurs.
Right. So they're doing more genetic analysis and comparing lemurs that they thought were the same are actually different now. So there are a lot of lemurs. And the amazing thing is that while Madagascar has been mostly deforested, there's still an incredible amount of biodiversity living in the little fragments of forest that remain. But what's particularly interesting about Madagascar is that the animals are, the term is ecologically naive. They're not necessarily that afraid of humans. So you can see lemurs much closer than you might be able to see monkeys in, say, the Amazon. There's been less hunting, and they just have a different mindset than a monkey. So you can really see a lot of animals up close, which is really a special experience. I mean, it's up there with going and seeing big game safari in Africa.
Is there no hunting, and that's why?
Well, there certainly is hunting. I'm not exactly sure the reason. They're less afraid of humans. It might have something to do with the history of predation, things of that nature. But you definitely notice it's not quite the Galapagos in terms of approachability, but you can get pretty close to a lot of lemurs. I mean, close enough to see them well.
Has the movie Madagascar increased tourism to or interest in the country?
It's kind of unclear. Originally, that was the hope. In 2004, there were great ambitions for linking the movie to tourism in Madagascar, but I think there was a bit of a disappointment in terms of the actual number of tourists who went to Madagascar as a result of the movie. I mean, the problem is that in reality, Madagascar is at least a 20-hour flight from the United States. It's kind of difficult to get around. Most people don't speak English. It's a poor country. It's off the coast of Africa. There's all sorts of reasons that make it not really a trip that you can do spur of the moment. So I think that that's been a big detriment. But I would say overall, it did increase awareness of Madagascar, and more people know now that Madagascar is a real place. I think when the movie first came out, a lot of people thought it was an imaginary place. And I guess you can understand that given the amount of the diversity of wildlife that lives there.
You know, what are some of the most interesting places or stories from your travels to all these different places. We've talked a little bit about Madagascar. I know you've also spent a lot of time in the Amazon.
Yeah, I mean, the Amazon's an interesting place. You're seeing a lot of development in parts of the Amazon, but then vast extents of the Amazon are essentially unchanged. I mean, you can fly for hours over the Amazon and see nothing but trees. But it, you know, in the southern reaches and some kind of the fringe areas, kind of the frontier, there is a lot of large scale development going on, and we're talking big time development. There are industrial farmers coming down from the American heartland to the Amazon and launching farms that are 10 times the size of what they had in the United States. So these are giant soy farms. And the scale of them is just incredible. In my reporting on the Amazon, I met a really interesting character named John Carter, who's originally a rancher from Texas. He moved to the Amazon in 96, and when it was really, he moved to the real frontier. Really, he's had some really crazy times there. He's not at heart an environmentalist, but the destruction around him was so great that he felt compelled to do something, and now he started up this organization that I would say is one of the most innovative in the Amazon and has probably one of the best chances to have a large-scale impact on the future of development in the Amazon in a positive way.
So what is he doing, and what country is he in?
He's in Brazil, and what he's doing is he's trying to get cattle ranchers to become part of the solution to addressing deforestation instead of just being the bad guys.
How's he doing this?
About 80%, the fate of about 80% of deforested land in the Brazilian Amazon is as cattle pasture. So basically you're seeing deforestation driven by cattle ranching. So the question is, how do you turn that around? John Carter is working on a certification system that would provide incentives for cattle ranchers to improve their environmental performance.
What do they have to do that, to get the certification?
Well, they have to maintain at least 50% forest cover on their land, which is something that we don't have here in the United States, but in the Brazilian Amazon is a law. So while it is a law in the Brazilian Amazon, there's very little enforcement. So basically, in a world where there is little governance, John Carr is working to create a system to ensure compliance by cattle ranchers. But beyond that, there are additional environmental guidelines that his organization is promoting.
And what's his organization called?
Aliança de Terra. It means Alliance of the Earth. So basically reducing the use of fire in land clearing. And in the Amazon, fire is a big deal. The Amazon isn't accustomed to burning. So a small fire that might only be a few inches high can do a lot of long-term damage to the forest. And so one issue you see in much of the Amazon is these agricultural fires that escape into natural forest do significant damage, and then subsequent fires can actually kill those trees. So he's trying to reduce the use of fire, as well as establish firefighting brigades to attack fires when they actually do break out. And they're setting up rules, working with some of the world's leading environmental scientists, setting up other guidelines for maintaining forest cover along waterways, and also registering ranches. So if you're part of their registry, then the cattle rancher would actually submit to remote sensing of their land. So there's sort of a monitoring capacity built into the system to ensure that people are complying with the environmental standards.
And is it working?
The initiative has been in progress for 6 or 7 years, and it's just right now reaching the finishing stages. So we'll have a better idea on how the system works a year or two from now. So it's a little too early to say at this point. But if you look at the structure and the mechanism, there's good reason to think that it should change things for the better, because the incentives are in the right place.
And where is the cattle, the beef going? Is it for beef?
Well, historically in the Amazon, most cattle ranching was actually used for land speculation or just establishing claims to land. But over the last 10 years, there's been a major change, and more cattle is being raised in the Amazon for actual beef and leather production. It's actually become a huge industry. In the Brazilian Amazon alone, they're more than 90 million head of cattle, which is almost as many cattle as in the entire United States. So Brazil is now the world's largest cattle producing country and exporter.
Really?
Yeah, by a significant amount. Most of that beef is either consumed domestically or a lot of it is exported. So it goes to Russia, China, Europe. Not so much goes to the United States because we have, I think we have a ban on fresh meat imports from Brazil, but some Brazilian beef ends up in processed products in the U.S.
Huh. And then when you've been there, have you seen a lot of wildlife? I mean, some of the elusive creatures like jaguar, or have you swum with the pink dolphins?
Yeah, I've seen jaguar and swam with the pink dolphins.
Really?
Yeah, so I mean, the Amazon, it's not like an African safari. It's not super easy to see animals. Animals tend to be elusive, and when they are around, they tend to camouflage well. But that said, it is possible to see some animals, especially if you take the time to look for them.
Where's the best place to see wildlife in the Amazon?
The best place actually to see Amazon wildlife is a little bit outside the rainforest. So in places like the Pantanal, which is a giant wetland kind of south of the Amazon, I've had some great experiences seeing jaguar there. You also see other big animals like tapir and capybara, which is a giant rodent. Those are really found everywhere outside or in the Pantanal. But when you're actually in the Amazon itself, you're more likely to see small things like frogs and lizards and insects, as well as birds. But it is easier to see animals, larger animals, outside the rainforest environment.
Yeah, I was there last September, and I didn't expect to see a whole lot because that's how it is in a rainforest like that, and it was very remote. But didn't see much, but it was great.
It was, yeah,
really interesting.
I mean, a lot of people go in and are disappointed because their expectations are kind of in the wrong place. You're not going to see, you know, a bunch of toucans joining you at breakfast, or, you know, a jaguar taking down a tapir in front of your lodge. The wildlife tends to be kind of cryptic and elusive. So, again, if you go in just looking for insects and just trying to enjoy the overall experience, then it's probably a better approach than hoping for an African safari type trip.
Now, you've also spent time in Africa. What have been some of the experiences in Africa? I know you've had quite a few elephant experiences.
Yeah, I've had two.
And sorry to ask about that, but they're interesting.
Yeah, I've had two elephant experiences that I probably would have rather not had. One of them happened in 2007, and I was in southern Kenya evaluating an area whether there was ecotourism potential. There had been ecotourism there 20 years ago, but now a person who operates in the region is looking to reestablish really low-impact, community-based birdwatching tours in this interesting forest area. So we went in and, you know, to walk around a bit and see what was in the forest, what the situation was like. And we pretty quickly realized that there were a lot of elephants in the forest based on the amount of damage to trees and the copious amounts of elephant dung everywhere. So we went for a long hike and were returning, and we got surprised by a group of elephants that charged us and pursued us for quite a while. I won't get into the full details, but one of the trackers was trampled by an elephant, but luckily was not injured very seriously. He was pretty smart about responding and managed to only get a few puncture wounds from the tusks, and he got tromped on his legs, but the soil was very soft, so he wasn't crushed. It just caused, you know, some pretty significant bruising. But it was quite an experience, and it really shows you the power of these animals. But there was also a conservation lesson in the whole experience, and that was it turns out that the reason there's so many elephants in this area is there's a lot of forest clearing right now around this area, and so these elephants are getting displaced into smaller patches of forest. And as they return to the areas which were traditionally their habitat, they're encountering agriculture. And so that's a new source of conflict. An elephant will go in and eat someone's maize or corn, and then the people will attack it. So it's a source of conflict for these elephants. So you have these kind of agitated elephants that are getting forced into smaller areas. And then we kind of walked into the middle of that situation. So in any case, it was an exciting experience, and you know, we learned some lessons from it.
And what is being done? We heard on another episode on Wildlife Friendly about elephant pepper, and you know, pepper plants being planted around crops because elephants hate pepper, and so we'll stay out of the crops. Is anything being done in this area that you know of to deal with this elephant, you know, farmer conflict?
Yeah, actually, I brought up that that elephant pepper approach when I was there, and they had never heard of it, so they liked the idea. They didn't really believe it would work, but anyway, it was something to look at. But I mean, a big problem is that the root of this conflict is you have people cutting down forests, which happens to be elephant habitat. So, I mean, I guess you can use pepper to protect against that, but there's still kind of the root problem of habitat loss. And so, you know, you have too many elephants for too little forest. So it's kind of a difficult situation. But maybe elephant pepper would work in some areas.
Or is there tourism to try and extend the habitat?
Well, I mean, our tourist experience was certainly... I don't think it would be suitable for most tourists. So they were looking at the possibility of establishing tourism there, which would bring in another source of income for these local people and perhaps help offset the cost of having elephants around their villages. There were some other activities that were being developed there, like honey harvesting. Honey is a big commodity for local tribes in this area. And their method for harvesting it was not really efficient. So they're now some outsiders have come in and introduced kind of new ways to produce honey in a way that will do less damage to the forest. There's also some other industries like reforestation with trees that are used for making poles that they surround their villages with. So instead of depleting the natural source of these for this timber, they'll actually grow their own. So things like that are hopeful, but in the long term, you know, tourism could help if you could really get community support and involvement in it, so they would actually benefit.
And what about, have you been gorilla tracking too?
I have gone and seen the gorillas. I saw the mountain gorillas in Uganda, and that's an interesting model. It's a good one for conservation. I think the price right now to see the gorillas is something like $500 a day for a permit, which is obviously a lot of money. So it's a bit of a problem in that it's not really democratic and open to everyone, but it generates a lot of money for gorilla conservation. And some of that money goes back to local communities through direct payments, but also by hiring local people as anti-poaching patrollers, porters, park rangers, things of that nature. So the benefit is you have a lot of money coming in for low impact tourism. So you're getting a lot of bang for a relatively small amount of visitors. I've also seen gorillas in a less structured environment in West Africa. Those are the lowland gorillas, which are far more abundant, but are facing a different sort of population trend. They're, unlike the mountain gorillas, which are increasing in population, the lowland gorillas are being hit by the bushmeat trade, Ebola outbreaks, and habitat loss. So while there are a lot more of them, they are decreasing in number. And my experience with the lowland gorillas was a bit wilder. I was actually charged by a silverback, which was quite a hair-raising experience. Having a 500 pound animal charge by you multiple times while beating its chest is enough to get your heart racing.
Yeah. What country was it that you were in?
It was in Gabon. And I was with some local rangers, and fortunately for me, I happen to be the tallest person, so I sort of stood out as kind of the dominant male of the group, even though that wasn't necessarily the case. But that's how the gorilla saw me, and so he picked me out as the male that he needed to show his dominance over. So it was quite a humbling experience.
Wow. So what did you do as you were being charged by this silverback? Did you hold your ground? Did you beat your chest too?
No, I think that would have been a bad idea. I was down on the ground. I mean, I got down on my knees and kind of put my head down to be submissive. And I mean, that solved a problem. I wasn't injured in any way, but it was, he ran by me beating his chest probably, I think, 8 or 9 times. And then he sort of let down his guard and we all quickly exited. We were just hiking. We weren't necessarily seeking out the gorillas. We kind of came upon this group. Somewhat unexpectedly, so it wasn't like an arranged experience or anything. It was very raw.
And what were you doing in Gabon? You've had a lot of wildlife encounters in Gabon, is that right?
Yeah. I mean, I never. That was my first trip to the Congo Basin, and so, you know, I had to go to the Congo Basin essentially. So I went to an interesting national park that was on the coast, that's fairly well managed and it's pretty well known.
What's it called?
Loango. Okay. They actually did a survivor there.
Oh, really?
A couple of years ago, yeah. I mean, after I went. But yeah, so it was my first time to the Congo rainforest, and it was definitely an interesting experience, and you're a lot more cautious when you walk around that forest than if you were in, say, South America or Asia. There's a lot more animals that can get you there. So,
and there are a lot of elephants there too, because I've heard about a lot of studies done there regarding poaching. Yeah.
Yeah. So that's a major research center for the Congo Basin, that very park, and they have forest elephants there. And I also had an experience with forest elephants. On that same trip where we were charged, but it was nothing as dramatic as the time in Kenya. But it was after that happened, that preceded the trip in Kenya. And so after we were charged with elephants, I actually went through the process of learning what to do when charged by elephants. And, of course in Kenya, I promptly forgot all that and just,
So what are you supposed to do when you are charged by elephants?
Well, I mean, there are different approaches. You know, you're supposed to, the easiest thing is to probably get behind a very large tree. That's actually what I try to do in Kenya. But unfortunately, none of the trees were large enough. And a small tree, an elephant will just run right through. So it's not going to help you much. The other things I was told is you can stand very still. Which when an elephant is charging you is maybe a little bit challenging to do, to really stand your ground. You can also throw something for the elephant to go after. So like a sweater or a jacket or something and wait for it while standing still and wait for it to attack that object. Again, I don't know if I would subscribe to either one of those approaches, in reality. I mean, just because when you have a several ton elephant bearing down on you, it's going to be pretty tough to stand your ground or have the presence of mind to try and distract the elephant by throwing a jacket or something. So I would almost always go for the tree option if possible.
Yeah,
in Gabon, you can also hide in the roots of of one of these stilt palm trees. Some people call them elephant. They refer to them as an elephant protection tree, because you can get inside there and the elephant really can't do much damage to you.
And then are there snakes and other things that hide in the stilt palm trees? As you're getting safety from the elephant.
Yeah. Again, that probably won't occur to you when you're running from the elephant. Yeah. Unfortunately, the option that works in some places, which is to just outrun everyone around you, doesn't work well with elephants because they're faster than people. So you can't just necessarily have better running shoes than your partner.
And then has it ever occurred to you that maybe elephants just don't like you?
Well, Well, I mean, I've seen a lot of elephants in my life, and I've only had those two experiences. So, and in either case, were we, you know, approaching the elephants or doing something that we weren't supposed to be doing? I mean, the second time we were completely ambushed and surprised by the elephants, and the first time there was a calf around, and I'm not sure what happened, but in either case, were we actually trying to find elephants? They found us.
So you don't take it personally.
No.
I saw, you know, you've done so many really, in my mind, extremely interesting interviews, and it's really amazing to have all that. And I was just wondering if some of those interviews, if anyone in particular stood out.
I've done several interviews with Dan Nepstad, who's with the Woods Hole Research Institute. Mm-hmm. And he's an expert on the Amazon, kind of. What's interesting about Dan is he does both macro and micro stuff. So he's looking at the entire ecosystem, but then he's sometimes also looking at very small elements of the ecosystem. And he's done such a broad and diverse array of research that really ties in with big picture issues in the Amazon. So he's one who's working with John Carter, who's the Texas cattle rancher from Texas, who's now developing this certification scheme to improve the environmental performance of cattle ranching. So it's actually, that effort was a collaborative one between the two of them. But Dan's also looking at the long-term impacts of climate change, specifically drought in the Amazon. And what he's found is somewhat terrifying in terms of just a few years of drought can really leave the forest susceptible to a forest fire and die off from stress. So it raises a lot of concerns, but Dan is also very hopeful about the potential of reducing the impact of certain types of activities in the Amazon, again, through the certification system. And he's also looked a lot at payments for ecosystem services. So looking at the value of carbon, but also water in the Amazon, and with the hope of compensating or providing incentives for landowners not to cut down forests. So my interviews with him have really stood out. Tying a little bit into that, I've had some interesting interviews with Andrew Mitchell of the Global Canopy Program. He's a scientist, but he's gotten increasingly interested in the whole payments for ecosystem services concept, which again aims to unlock the value of ecosystems, but specifically forests in this case, as living healthy entities. So capturing the value of the water they provide, erosion control, the carbon they store, all these things that we generally take for granted from the ecosystems around us, but actually have a tangible value.
And in terms of Monga Bay and the reporting of these types of activities, I mean, because they aren't really well known or well reported elsewhere. At the beginning, you had given several impacts of Monga Bay, and I'm just wondering about other sort of more general impacts and some of the advantages of being an online news source.
Well, a big focus of Monga Bay is education and outreach. So I have a site for children that's been up since for 6 or 7 years that reaches a lot of kids every month. And I've actually made a big effort to have that site put in multiple languages. So I think it's now in 33 languages.
Wow.
And so the idea is to make this information freely available to as many people as possible. And I have PDFs, so it's easy to print a copy of this and, you know, hand it out in schools or what have you. And I've actually encountered people out in the field who have Monga Bay materials printed out for kids in a remote village. It's
really pretty, that must be heartening.
Yeah, it's happened in Madagascar, happened in Thailand, and I saw it somewhere else. Yeah, I mean, it's very much a surprise when I see it. I mean, that's the whole point of what I'm doing. So that's the education component of Monga Bay, and I'm planning this summer to do a lot more work in that area, and actually bring in some professional teachers or some teachers to help with the effort.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So that's that's a project. That's one of the many projects that I have kind of that aren't necessarily apparent at the moment on the site, but are happening in the background. But in terms of the advantages of being online, I think production costs are obviously a lot lower. It's very easy to get information, to disseminate information, and then also update it. So, I can go back and improve the children's site as more research becomes available, or as I get feedback from teachers, things of that nature. It's also, as I travel around, I see that the internet is definitely expanding throughout the world. So there's a lot better access in places that were once very remote. Someone will have a cell phone where they can, access the internet via their phone. So having the site, which is may not look like it, but it's actually a very basic site. It's all done in there's no Flash or anything. It's very, very simple HTML code. So it especially the children's site tends to load pretty quickly in bandwidth constrained environments. So, that's been one of the goals of the site, is to make it accessible to as many people as possible, especially the children's sections.
Interesting. And have you seen a lot, more competition for this kind of site? Because over the years, or especially just recently, you've seen a lot of environment reporters basically losing their jobs, and you see a lot of established news organizations just switching to either online only editions or just folding entirely. How has the recession affected you, or affected the site, I should say?
Yeah, well, so I guess there's sort of two issues there. In terms of competition, I don't spend a lot of time looking at websites. I'm kind of too busy, so I don't know the competitive landscape for MangaBay that well. I do notice a lot more green sites out there, green-oriented sites. I mean, they seem to be disappearing now, given the recession, which I'll get to in a moment. But I'm not really too worried about competition. The goal of MangaBay is to reach out and spread awareness. So if there are more sites that are spreading awareness about environmental issues and doing it accurately, I mean, if sites aren't doing it accurately, then that becomes problematic. But if they're just out there spreading the word and being successful at it, then that's overall, that's great. So I don't worry too much about it. I mean, that's kind of the mission of MangaBay to do outreach. Mm-hmm. In terms of the recession, it's had a major impact on the on MangaBay, and I assume on other sites. It seems like a lot of green advertising networks and also green oriented websites are shutting down or scaling back, and that's because from my standpoint, I've seen a huge decline in advertising. I think there's just been a general pullback in ad spending. But in the green sector especially, kind of as the economy soured, people are going to be spending less money on green, more expensive green products. And so, I think I've really seen that impact. So saw a huge drop off in advertising probably in late 2008. And I live very modestly, and my expenses are low, so it's not hard for me to not draw a salary for a few months. I just save money and spend money wisely. But if I were a larger organization that had a large payroll, then it would certainly be a difficult time. I mean, it was a difficult time as it was, but as a small operation, I can not draw a salary for 6 months and get by. But I wouldn't say the same about, if you had 10 or 20 employees, it would be much more challenging, I think.
And what has your experience with MangaBay taught you? What can it teach others in the environmental news business? Because it does have this huge exposure. Oh, it seems like a lot of environmental journalists are struggling with, exposure and making it a viable economic enterprise, as well as getting the information out there and getting it right, because it seems like a lot of information out there, a lot of blogs, the information content has exploded, but the accuracy hasn't necessarily followed suit.
Yeah. There's a lot of rewriting kind of other content. And then when some people rewrite it, sometimes they get it wrong, which can be frustrating. I get frustrated when I see MangaBay content that gets misrepresented, or you know, some of the facts, some of the details are left out, which then make the content inaccurate. So that's kind of frustrating. Reporting. There's a lot of misinformation out there. I'm amazed by by newspaper columnists who can write things that are completely inaccurate, and then there's no repercussions on it. Just they have this established column, and then they can basically make up what they want from a scientific perspective and pass it off as legitimate content. It actually kind of blows my mind that there's no sort of check system or any way of policing that sort of stuff, or you know, there's sort of no repercussions for these columnists. I've been seeing a lot with climate change writing. Looking specifically at Amazon, there's been an Amazon Gate scandal, which for all I can see, there's no scandal. The IPPC cited a report by WWF, which they shouldn't have done. They should be citing the scientific research, but the underlying there's nothing wrong with the underlying research, but now it's being passed off as some big scandal. And it just, the people who've been, the columnists who've been writing about this issue have been getting the facts quite wrong. I mean, they're obviously not even looking at the original research. They're just spinning it in their head or something. It's kind of mind-boggling. But there's no downside for them. I mean, they're still writing these columns, so there's no reason for them to stop, I guess, if they're not going to be called out on it. I mean, they're called out on it by blogs or whatever, but their audience is a lot bigger than the people who read those blogs.
Well, if someone wants to get into the job of writing about wildlife, what advice would you have for them?
Well, starting a new... From a financial standpoint, starting a new blog is a challenging endeavor. It's the economics aren't very good right now. I mean, I'll be honest, it's a tough environment. So I definitely wouldn't get into it for the money. But
good advice right there.
Yeah, but if you're really passionate about the issue and you know, are happy to pursue it because of your passion, then that's great. And if you're a good writer and can tell good stories, then starting a blog might be a good way to land an actual paying job somewhere else. You know, if you build a following, then you may be hired by, you may be able to land freelance work or write a book or latch on with a news organization. Or even, you know, join a conservation group that's looking to tell their story better. So I would certainly encourage people to develop their writing and look for stories and, you know, start up websites or blogs. But just be wary that it may not necessarily be a very profitable endeavor. You should sort of look for the other potential benefits rather than making a lot of money from running a website. Because from experience, it's not a super profitable endeavor. I mean, I still haven't made as much money on an annual basis from running Manga Bay as I did when I first left school and joined a consultancy when I was, you know, 20 years old. So I'm certainly not in it for the money.
Well, I really appreciate your taking the time to talk with me.
Well, sure. Well, I really appreciate the invite. So thank you for the opportunity.
I hope you enjoyed those insights into strategies for raising public awareness of wildlands and wildlife with Rhett Butler, a writer and conservationist who founded MangaBay.com, a top environmental website. Now, let me play you today's creature call once again and see if you've guessed it correctly. This week's creature call is the sound from a pinniped that you can often see showing off its natural behaviors in shows at zoos, aquariums, and circuses. You've probably seen them often and listened to the variety of their strange sounds, from barks to honks to trumpets and roars. In fact, a baby or pup can pick out its mother from among hundreds just from her sound. Do you know what it is yet? It's from a California sea lion. Listen to its sounds. For next week's creature call, I'll play the sound from a mammal that lives in the dense lowland forests of Southeast Asia. Here's your preview. Be sure to tune in next week when I'll replay this strange sound from the wild world and reveal the animal that made it.
Archived episodes of The Wildlife are available on iTunes, at my website, laurelnemi.com, and at laurelnemi.podbean.com. You can stream The Wildlife live at theradiator.org every Monday from 1 to 2 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. And, of course, if you have comments about this show or ideas for future ones, you can email me at laurel@laurelnemi.com.
The Wildlife is generously underwritten by the Lake Champlain Land Trust, a nonprofit organization permanently conserving the lands, lakeshore, critical wildlife habitats, and natural areas of Lake Champlain. More information is available online at lclt.org. This has been The Wildlife. I'm your host, Laurel Nemi, and you're listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMM LP, in Burlington, Vermont.